can see, but not for me. I sit and watch as tears go by. My rich is kept by everything. I want to hear the children sing. All I hear is the sound of rain falling on the ground. I sit and watch as tears go by. It is the evening of the day. I sit and watch the children play, doing things I used to do. They think of you. I sit and watch as tears go by.
Make a place that no one Behind us now, the Pastels from the Unfair Kind of Fame EP 1996. The My Bloody Valentine remix of Cycle. Preceded by Les Rennes Prochaines, Evening from Lub Erchrum Dank. Blonde Redhead, Love or Prison, the Castellet mix from the Here Sometimes 12-inch single. Vamis, Nightingale, or 460 Above Westwood Carborough, self-titled Thing. Five great tracks from, let's make that six, from 60 interpretations of 60 seconds by 60 solo improvisers. We heard Lindsay Pollock, Rubber Glove Bagpipes, Chaz Smith, Copper Box, Rachel Arnold, Cello, Fatima Miranda, Voice Field Recordings, Yuichi Onue, Kaisatsu, Todd Taylor, Banjo, The Noisettes did The Proverbial It Girl, K11 and Philippe Petit did Doppelganger Presence, Phantom Pain Days did Paradox Box, US Girls Take Over Dynamics, and The Founders did Sunwalk. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope Worldwide, WFMU.org. Stay tuned. Too much information. Benjamin Walker is next.
Yes, I was watching the commercial, and I saw the poor children on the commercial, and I don't have my children anymore. Well, I've got my two grandkids here.
Uh-huh.
And they're very unbehaved little kids. So I wanted to sponsor a behaved child.
Okay.
Get away from there. What did I tell you? Hold on a second.
Uh-huh.
No. Get away from there. God.
Okay, you want to sponsor a child?
Yes.
Your name, please?
Gladys.
And the last name?
Ridgeford.
Can you spell that for me, please?
That's R as in really, I as in incredibly intelligent, D as in diverse, G as in G.
Okay.
Ford as in the automobile.
So if you have an
Get
E in between?
Get away from there. What did I tell you? Get the hell away from there. I'm sorry. Hello?
Yes.
I heard your show as I listen faithfully every week to the podcast, you know, too much information, and I can't help but tell you that I was a little insulted, offended. You did this summer vacation thing, and I was wondering why I didn't make the cut.
Well, you know, it's weird because I kind of was assuming I would end with you because I go on this, you know, journey across America, and we hear from all the TMI regulars, and obviously, you know, you're an important a cast member.
I should be.
You are. I get emails, and no one wants to talk about anything other than, who's that guy in L.A.? He's the best. But then the tape was just too depressing. I mean, I know we hung out in your apartment and recorded, but every time I listened to the recording, I got depressed. I mean,
I would like to counter that, if I may. What's depressing? The apartment is, remember, it's like yellow. It's painted yellow. What's depressing? I have two cats.
You had,
that's hardly depressing.
You had a room under the stairs with dirt and spiders in it with a sleeping bag spread out that you were saying.
Yeah, I was trying to get a roommate to pay half.
That was going to be your new couch surfing abode, which I thought people would be excited to hear about because, you know, the last time we heard from you, you know, you were getting evicted from the other place for punching your neighbor, but it was too depressing.
I don't understand why depressing you think isn't arable.
Well, no, I just needed a moment of lightness. You know, I figured
Don't count on me for that. Why can't you get the moment of lightness from one of your girlfriends?
I was thinking that...
I gave you the big tour of my apartment, and I showed you all the pictures on my wall, and I gave you my drugs that I need, and what do I get? There's no mention of me? You know it's going to hurt my feelings, and that's what motivates you.
Do you have me on speakerphone?
I'm sorry, this is as good as it gets, caller. I'm eating fried chicken, though. Caller, go ahead.
I would like to do a Peter Choi segment that's kind of about happiness and you know, making it.
Well, you got it today. You know why? If I can get them to not shut off the phone and the internet, man, I'm going to be happy. You know, I think I lost her, though. I think she's not... Am I on hold still?
What's going on? Why is your phone getting cut off?
I haven't paid the bill for 3, 4, 5 months. Oh, my God, they've been on hold so long.
So you're about to get your phone shut off.
And electricity. I've got till 5. At least they're on hold with me. They'll answer. Any moment. I've been on hold for I don't know, a couple hours now. But I got my, I've been doing this for 2 months, saving off my creditors. I got the cat in the bag.
So what do you tell the people that want to, like, shut off your electricity and your phone? You know, what do you say?
What I do is I try to get in their shoes. You got to imagine this. Be smart, all right? They're answering the phone for $10 an hour. They're hearing every hard luck story in the world, right? Be a little different. Be creative. I try to explain to them their part of their role in the machine. You understand how they're being exploited?
Uh-huh.
How, and they kind of are with me because at least it's a different kind of phone call. And I'm lighthearted and making fun, you know, making, tell, ask them, because they give you their name now. You know, all these companies, the, what is it called? The friend, remember it was called the friendly face of fascism, but there's another word for under capitalism, the kind face of capitalism. Hi, my name is Judy Wills. I'm your representative. I hope I can service you well. Every time you call up a utility, they do that now.
Uh-huh.
Because they don't know to say, hi, my name is Judy Wills, and I'm being exploited by one of the 7 top companies in the world that own the rest of the world, and I'm only getting paid $10 an hour. You know what? When I get the right person on the phone, I start talking to them about the monetary system. I inform them of things I didn't even know. Do you know that AT&T is one of the 7 companies that control the world? And that you're just getting, like, what is it called? The trickle-down? The tiny little trickle-down where there's 6 guys in very shady suits on top of skyscrapers in New York that are reaping trillions of dollars. But this is what I have to say about it. They made up the whole monetary system because it benefits them. We could stop with it tomorrow and, like, give everybody their equal share, you know, the world's resources, reallocate everything, and get rid of Wall Street, maybe fly another plane into it, but without the Islamic terrorists, just get rid of it.
This is what you were going to tell the lady who's about to shut off your phone.
I don't take up more than my fair share of the world's resources. I don't have credito facile like some of these people here with the big car. Hey, big car! Hey, I just jumped over barbed wire and swam the Rio Grande to get out of one dictatorship. Why don't I get into the world's biggest monetary scam, credito facile, and drive a big car? Can you imagine the peasants of the third world are also hypnotized and they come here? People complain about illegal immigration. I'm like, you should be glad that anyone wants to come here.
What is that sound in the background?
It's the AT&T. I have to talk to them about. Oh, look, she's on the phone. Hold on. Hello, hello. Peter Choice here. Hello, yes, yes. Hello, hello.
Can I make you very satisfied today?
Oh, Ben, do you sure you
yes,
want to listen?
Yes, I do.
Hi, my name is Peter Choice. Do you have my information? Oh, I have to start over. My number is 213-8-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9-9- I wanted to do is cancel the cell phone. I tried to do this in July because I foresaw this financial situation. I'm expecting money, and I know that I can't rely on the money coming in, kind of, without the long story, which involves, the Far East. Oh, no, she gave me to you. No, she was very smart. Oh, my God. They knew it. Okay, I'm on hold again. Go ahead.
Oh, no. What are you trying to do?
The internet, yes. I don't care about the cell phone. I don't want it. It's out of my... I can't afford a cell phone.
How are you going to live without a cell phone?
Say that again, please call.
How are you going to live without a cell phone?
Anyway, yes, I'm a disabled person. I was told by my friend to get a cell phone, but I can't afford it. I only have a check,
Why don't you just leave the texting on? Like, you could do text. You could do text calls. You could just do texting.
I don't do text. Shut up. I can't see. Hold on a second.
It's cheaper. Just keep the texting on, Peter.
Wait, I'm on two phones. He thinks I text, and I've never texted in my life. I refuse.
Texting is cheaper. You can at least...
Teenage technology. I don't want it. I'll have nothing to do with
Leave texting. The texting on. What if you have an emergency?
I wanted to text my... Well, emergency is why I had the cell phone. I can't afford the cell phone. It's $100 a month. They're always telling me it's like $60 a month, and it's always $100
Ask her if there's a texting plan.
That's why the phone bill's so big.
Ask her if there's a texting plan.
No, I don't want texting. I never will use this keyboard to type. So, Can I
cancel? Ma'am, don't let him cancel the texting.
Without having to pay this. All right, thank you. Okay, go ahead. I've been on hold all day, but go ahead. Dude, where are they putting me?
Why are you trying to turn off your cell phone?
Okay, I have a freaking landline, like I've always had throughout my whole life. I was fine with it. And you know what? The landline can call you in New York. I'm very disappointed in the future, now that we're here. Nothing under the monetary system. Since man landed on the moon, that was the height of technology. Everything has been downhill since then. CDs, as opposed to records. I mean, what, we have automatic banking? The internet? Dude, radio, television, the telephone itself. The highest forms of technology, all invented in the last century, years ago. But I'm not into texting, all right? You'll never convince me. That's like, why don't you play a video game? Hey, why don't you just put a telegram on the phone? That's a nice app. It's Tinker Toy technology. It's for the benefit of one of the seven companies that rule the world. And I'm just opposed to it. I'm taking a stand here. You know what? I can't afford it, all right? You've got me. I never understood why you got hypnotized and why you accept these things. You know, we could be living in the future world like the Jetsons, but we have text messaging instead.
Peter, I'm telling you, you can compromise here. If you have the texting, it should be cheaper. And then if you have an emergency...
I don't text, and I'll never text. I'm against teenage technology. I'm just politically opposed to it.
About your wireless service.
You know what you need to get a text message? Friends. I don't have friends. I need to talk to Central Casting to work. That's
all. But what if you need to text them and say, I'm late. I'm stuck on the highway.
I don't, because I'll get off and I'll use a phone booth. I'll use someone else's cell phone, all right? I know how to do that. You go in the breakdown lane and you pull down your pants and someone will stop. Hello? Go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Ma'am? What did you say?
Creepy down here, sorry.
That's very nice and homey, though.
Yeah, I'm the only one who lives down here in the basement, so it's a little rapey.
Cartoonist Julia Wirtz lives in a basement apartment in Greenpoint. And even though this is my first visit, I've seen the place before. She's drawn all the apartments she's lived in since moving to New York in 2007 in her autobiographical comic book, Fart Party. This is definitely the nicest one. Even if it is a little rapey.
When I first moved to New York, I was living off of Broadway, which is the border of Bushwick and Bed-Stuy, which is it's kind of like the festering asshole of New York. It's just gross and grungy. I actually kind of liked it. But that was apartment number one. And then I moved around a little bit. I'd been house-sitting for a while in Clinton Hill. Then I lived in Williamsburg for 2 months, which I absolutely hated. And then I moved to Greenpoint in this apartment, which I found off Craigslist. And they told me when I showed up that it was a misprint, that it was a basement studio with no windows. And as you can see, there are three windows. So no one had answered but me to the ad.
Julia tells the story of her life in these apartments and her move to New York and her new Fart Party collection, Drinking at the Movies.
I was very aware of how doing a, you know, young girl moves to New York and crazy things happen, then it's okay. Like, that's the most, like, played out story in probably, like, American stories that you can do. But it doesn't really concern me because I just do what I do and I tell the stories and it happened and I can't pretend it didn't happen. I just, you know, I write about what happened and if it was a cliche, then so, you know, so be it.
Some of the things that happened at 20-something Julia are definitely cliches. The crap apartments, the crappier dates, the even crappier jobs, and the 1 million hangovers. But her humor and style makes it seem like the wacky things that happened to her could only happen to her. Like the time she comes to in a laundromat in her pajamas.
I don't really know the events that led up to waking up in the laundromat, but I just sort of found myself this laundromat off of Broadway in my pajamas, and I was eating Cracker Jacks, like the kind from the quarter machine. I didn't even know they still made those. It even had a prize in it, too. I don't know what it was. And I sort of realized at that point that the way I was living was unmanageable and ridiculous. Like, I only hope that I do that once in my life because I don't ever want to, you know, wake up in a laundromat again. But, you know, the whole book is ridiculous, so that kind of moment just sort of is like the pinnacle.
Julia moved to New York from the Bay Area, kind of on a whim, leaving her friends and family behind. And she feels guilty about this, really guilty. She's convinced something bad is going to happen because she's not around to look after her brother, who's not doing so great.
One of the things I felt really guilty about in my move to New York was leaving my older brother, who I'm very close with. And the event that I talk about in the book that I had a lot of guilt surrounding was his last overdose before he went to rehab. I was in a bar at the time, and I got the phone call that he had gone missing. And I had sort of known, because I'm not identical twins with my brother, but you know when you have that phantom limb syndrome, when there's something wrong with your family, you kind of feel it. Like, you know something's wrong. So I sort of knew something was wrong. So I was looking at him and judging him for doing all of these things. And the whole time that I was doing that, I was drunk. Like, I was rarely sober. And I didn't understand that we were doing the same thing. Like, the parallels between our story at that time, that's just what I did. It took about 2 years until I realized that I was doing the exact same thing he'd been doing, just in a different manner.
There is a lot of drinking, as the book's title suggests, and while it does seem to get Julia in a lot of trouble, it's still surprising to see, on the last page, Julia dump her bottle in a trash can and announce she's done with drinking.
I said I quit drinking when the book ended at the beginning of 2009, which is not true. I went full force for over a year, and then I ended up in rehab, and that was not my plan. I was like, oh, I'm going to finish this book, and in the book I'll say that I stop drinking and it'll be easy and that'll be the end of it. And it wasn't the end of it. I carried it out longer. I don't show in the book how it was sabotaging things as well as I wish I had. Like, I didn't explain in the book that the reason I got fired from those two jobs was because I was drinking on the job. So it's not quite as accurate a portrayal as it maybe it should have been. Like, when I'm locking myself out of the apartment, it's because I was drinking. And I didn't really put that into the book. And
why not?
Probably self-preservation at the time. Also, I didn't really understand. While I was making those comics, I was still drinking too, so I didn't really have time to separate and understand that that was why all these things happened. I just thought it was happening because that was my life. I didn't understand that it was a direct correlation. So at that time, I was like, you know, thought that the comics would be what got me through that, but that doesn't really work when you're drinking like that. You can't be like, oh, I'll fix myself through making comics about it or making a book about it. You have to take it further just as a person before, you know, you actually realize that what you can't keep living that way, which is what happened to me. Like, the comics did not affect what happened in real life at all when it came down to it. So I created a world that I could live in where everything seemed manageable when it wasn't in real life. But, you know, I kind of blurred the lines between the comic world and real world. So, you know, if I'd been completely honest, which I don't think I was capable of doing at that time, maybe I would have seen it sooner. I sort of feel this when I look back at my work. There's a wall between the character that I portray and then the reader. And for me, that wall was like the creative wall of drinking. And I couldn't exactly look at my own life and what I was doing while I was still drinking. So the comics sort of had that feel to it. Like, that's why everything sort of ends with a joke. It wraps up in 9 panels. And that is not how anyone actually lives, you know, that's why comics are so fun, though, is because you can do that and you can put everything in panels like that. But you know, nothing ever wraps up like that. So the work I've been doing still sort of follows that path, but I'm much more willing to admit when I think or do or say something that's totally uncool or unfunny, which is all the time in my real life. So hopefully, like, that'll help me be able to inject a little bit more honesty into what I do without, you know, I don't want to become one of those bleeding heart cartoonists who's like, oh, everything's the worst. And, you know, that might be honest, but that's boring and tedious.
Now, I can't imagine Julia Wirtz ever getting boring or tedious, but she does have good reason to worry about losing the audience, because the audience likes that make-believe world where everything is whacked out and fun and wraps up in 9 panels, too. But recently, Julia did a reading at Atomic Books in Baltimore, something she does every year, and she tried out some of her new work.
You know, I read some story, and afterwards, the past few years, it's been very jovial afterwards. Like, people talk to me, ask me to sign books, you know, it's a fun time. And this time, I read a story that referenced going to rehab, and it was sort of new. I hadn't really talked about it in the comics yet, and afterwards, nobody talked to me, and nobody asked me to sign any books. It was just crickets for an hour after the reading, and it was so awkward. But I assume that'll sort of blow over.
Or will it, though? Maybe that's the thing, that you were just like an artistic genius, showing your artistic genius by like keeping that out of the book.
Probably. That means my work from now on is going to be very subpar.
There's something wrong with my computer. Files keep moving around, jumping from folder to folder, all on their own accord. For example, the segment that started this program, the one with Peter Choice, that was supposed to go in next week's radio program, and thus the file was in the TMI 28 folder. But then, the other day, it just showed up in the TMI 27 folder, which is this week's program. Perhaps I have a virus, or perhaps my computer's been hacked, or perhaps it's just a ghost, a well-meaning ghost. You see, while my initial reaction to finding that Peter Choice file in the TMI 27 folder was frustration and astonishment, it wasn't until I physically saw it there, next to the Julia Wirtz file, that I realized, why yes, these two segments would sound kind of great together. I mean, Peter and I talk about that depressing tour he gave me of his apartment in L.A., and then Julia gives me a tour of her Greenpoint apartment, which she jokingly calls rapey. And so, I decided to use the Peter Choice segment in this week's program. And, as you just heard, the two segments do sorta work well together. All of my radio programs come together like this, except for the computer problem part. But there really is no rhyme or reason to the process. These programs have no overarching themes. I am not a fan of themed radio programs. I've worked on a number of them for other radio stations. And what always tends to happen is this. Someone suggests a segment idea, and then someone else says, well, it doesn't fit the theme. And then this idea is tossed out. Unless it is lucky enough to get scrawled on a post-it note and attached to a whiteboard for possible inclusion in a future program, one with an appropriate theme. But this is only the illusion of luck, because these post-it notes are never taken down. They just hang there, sometimes for months, until they lose the strength to cling on, and then they tumble to the floor and are swept away by the overnight cleaning lady. I've always identified with these segments, and I vowed to myself that if I ever got my own radio program, I would never make it a themed show. These Too Much Information programs have titles, not themes. A title is very different than a theme. A title can be evocative, descriptive, explanatory, or even just a catchy phrase. Sometimes the titles actually have nothing to do with the programs. For example, my favorite program so far is Something Will Happen Soon. And this is just something a woman told me once when I inquired about our situation. My computer is also moving emails around, hiding them in strange places. For example, I got an email last week from my old boss offering a critique of my radio program, and somehow it ended up in the trash can before I even read it. He says I'm doing it all wrong. He says, as the host, it's my job to set up the program at the top and explain to the listener what the hour is all about. But this is something I refuse to do. I believe it's insulting to the intelligence of the listener. I mean, do you really need to keep listening after someone tells you what you're going to hear? This is why I don't even announce the title at the top of the program. But for the sake of argument, let's test it out. Let me prove to you that I'm right. This week's program is called Sabotage. See? What did I tell you? I just went and ruined it. But I hope, dear listener, you'll stick around for the rest of the program. As for me, I need to figure out what the hell is going on with this computer.
Malware is just a generic word for nasty stuff on your computer. It can mean a Trojan horse program, which is a type of program that lets the attackers take control of your computer. It could mean a virus. It could mean spyware or adware. Just anything kind of that you don't want on your computer, people just generically call it malware.
Nart Villeneuve is a senior research fellow at the Citizens Lab at the University of Toronto, where he studies malware as part of the Information Warfare Monitor.
The kind of thing that I've been looking at is a much more targeted application of malware. So people who work in the human rights area, although it's increasingly affecting people who work in government and for large companies as well, they get an email that's usually targeted towards them or their organization. And the email is crafted to encourage them to either click on a link in the email or open an attachment that comes with the email. And if they do either of those things, there's a good chance that their computer is going to get compromised, at which point the attackers have full control and tend to start removing documents and any kind of sensitive information that they can exploit off the computer. They need to trick you into clicking on something. Once you click on it, you're usually done. Your computer will be compromised. And the malware that they use doesn't have to be particularly sophisticated or advanced. The point I like to stress to people is that what they're really doing is exploiting humans.
Yeah, but here is where it seems to get kind of tricky. I mean, I'm smart enough to know not to click on something that says I've just won $2 million or that some girl has listened to me on the radio and fallen in love with me and now she wants me to read her poetry. Click here. I think most of us intuitively understand that this is a bad idea.
Yeah.
But it seems that thanks to sites like Facebook, we're clicking on things we don't know who or where they come from all the time now.
Yeah, I think people don't realize how much information about themselves they reveal through social networking platforms, and attackers are increasingly becoming aware of that. There are malware families like the Kubeface family that spread through Facebook. The attackers are realizing the value in that information that we volunteer about ourselves and use that against us to establish trust. Awareness about how much information you reveal about yourself online is extremely important.
So this is why you took yourself off Facebook then, Nart, isn't it?
I still have some accounts, but just to test malware.
So how does this work then on the computer side of things? Once humans click on a link or download something, what happens next?
So what happens is that the people who want to spread the malware either develop or acquire zero-day exploits. These are bugs in computer programs that there is no fix for that the attackers can use to put the malware onto your computer. There's no fix available. They'll work even if your computer is up to date with the latest security patches. So what you see is When the attackers really want to compromise somebody, they'll burn one of these zero-day exploits. And I say burn because once they use it, it usually gets out into the open. Security researchers can find it and then start developing fixes for it. So really, once you use a zero-day, you're kind of, you know, it won't stay a zero-day for very long. So they're kind of don't want to waste these for no reason. They want to maximize the impact. So they'll, you know, acquire or develop one of these exploits and then start using it against the targets they want to exploit.
So let's talk about Stuxnet, this nasty piece of super malware that's in the news right now for supposedly attacking Iran's nuclear operation.
Yeah.
There's a lot of speculation about who and why it was built, but let's start with explaining what it is and how it works.
Well, what's interesting about Stuxnet is that it didn't just use one zero-day exploit, but I believe now researchers have found that it used four zero-day exploits. So there's a lot of planning and resources behind the development or acquisition of those exploits. The other thing that was interesting is it's the first documented malware that has specific instructions to do something, it's unclear exactly what, to SCADA devices made by Siemens. And SCADA devices are like the control systems for industrial operations, like power plants or factories. And that is somewhat uncommon, you know, in normal malware that wants to compromise a PC.
And I think this is why this whole story is so confusing to me, because even if Stuxnet was designed to take out Iran's nuclear systems, it will end up infecting industrial systems, other ones as well. And in fact, Stuxnet is turning up in countries all over the world. But really, I mean, hey, let's design a computer virus to mess with nuclear reactors. How is this not the dumbest idea ever?
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem with doing these kind of operations through the internet, is that there are a lot of unintended consequences, that it's difficult once these exploits get out into the world and once the malware starts spreading, it's very difficult to control what happens. But it is a good example of why critical systems shouldn't be connected to the internet, and you know why care needs to be taken in the design of these sort of critical infrastructure systems. So I mean, it's unclear to me what the actual damage would be from Stuxnet, but I think what is interesting about it is its potential. The people that were behind Stuxnet, you know, set a new bar in terms of how viciously you can go after, you know, a target using malware.
Obviously, there's a lot of speculation on exactly who is behind Stuxnet. And since Iran seems to be the primary target, most of this speculation is pointing to the United States or Israel. But how difficult is it to actually figure out where something like Stuxnet comes from?
It's very difficult to determine through technical means who is behind these kind of attacks. And it's very easy to pretend to be somebody else. And if countries start developing offensive capabilities to strike back, you know, that has huge potential dangers, especially if you can trick someone into believing that they've been attacked by somebody else. And one of the dangers that I've been talking about, and especially the Citizen Lab has been warning about, is sort of an escalation as more actors become involved and they keep pushing the boundaries of these kind of attacks. We'll start to see you know, offensive measures taken more seriously. A lot of talk that's come out of the United States you know, with the creation of the U.S. Cyber Command, is that it needs offensive capabilities in cyberspace. So, if you think about what that means and what the opportunities are for collateral damage and how fast things can spin out of control because it's too easy to pretend to be somebody else and to launch an attack. And if an attack was misinterpreted and someone else was given responsibility and then were counterattacked, I just think that's opening the door to huge problems, not just in terms of international relations, but also disrupting the internet for everybody because people start getting involved in sort of this escalation of conflict online. For me, that's the scariest.
This is actually what's scaring me too, because while Stuxnet is definitely something that takes us a step closer to cyber war, it's also a huge step forward for cyber intrigue. Or to put it in the language of Joseph Conrad, cyber sabotage. Joseph Conrad's novel, The Secret Agent, first saw publication in the American magazine Ridgeways, a militant weekly for God and country, in 1906. The story was timely. Anarchist terrorism was everywhere. In 1894, an Italian anarchist assassinated French President Sadi Carnot. In 1897, anarchists fatally stabbed Empress Elizabeth of Austria. And in 1901, an American anarchist killed William McKinley, the President of the United States. At the beginning of the 20th century, anarchist terrorism was the leading preoccupation of politicians, police chiefs, journalists, and writers. Joseph Conrad was not the only author to take a stab at terrorism. James, Dostoevsky, many writers incorporated the headlines into their work. But The Secret Agent is the first novel to address the political intrigue behind the bombings and the assassinations. The book begins with our protagonist, Mr. Verloc, closing up his smut shop in a seedy section of London. But that's just a cover. He's really a vice president of the Future of the Proletariat Society, an anarchist cell. But this is just a cover as well, because in truth, Verloc is a secret agent for, well, Conrad never really comes out and names the country Verloc is working for. The only name he gives us is Verloc's handler, a one Mr. Vladimir. But just as Mr. Vladimir suggests Russia today, it also did in 1906. Now, Verloc is summoned to the embassy because Mr. Vladimir wants more than just information. Our Mr. Vladimir explains to Verloc that if his government is going to continue to pay him to be an agent provocateur, then there had better be some provocateuring. Mr. Vladimir explains to Verloc that at an upcoming conference in Milan, the leaders of the world will draw up a plan to deal with terrorism. And in order for this plan to be successful, England must be brought on board. Mr. Vladimir explains to Verloc that England is too caught up with issues of individual liberties and personal freedoms. If anything is to be done at Milan, then England must be made to see that the only appropriate response to terrorism is total commitment, even if it means total war. Mr. Vladimir's remarks to Verloc are extraordinary, and if you don't mind, I'd like to share them with you in their entirety. What we want is to administer a tonic to the conference in Milan. Its deliberations upon international action for the suppression of political crime don't seem to get anywhere. England lags. This country is absurd with its sentimental regard for individual liberty. The imbecile middle classes of this country make themselves the accomplices of the very people whose aim it is to drive them out of their houses to starve in the ditches. The middle classes are stupid. They have no imagination. They are blinded by an idiotic vanity. What they need just now is a jolly good scare. This is the psychological moment to set your anarchist friends to work, Mr. Verloc. I have called you here today to develop to you my idea. It is my idea that you and your terrorist comrades commit a series of outrages. Now, these outrages need not be especially sanguinary, but they must be sufficiently startling, effective. Let them be directed against buildings, for instance.
let them be directed at something all the bourgeoisie can recognize. Now, the fetish of today is neither royalty nor religion. Therefore, the palace and the church should be left alone. An attempt upon a crowned head or on a president is sensational enough in a way, but not so much as it used to be. It has entered into the general conception of the existence of all chiefs of state. It's almost conventional, especially since so many presidents have been assassinated. Now, then, let us take on an outrage upon, say, a church. Horrible enough on first sight, no doubt, and yet not so effective as a person of an ordinary mind might think. No matter how revolutionary and anarchist in inception, there would be fools enough to give such an outrage the character of a religious manifestation, and that would detract from the special, alarming significance we wish to give the act. A murderous attempt on a restaurant or a theater would suffer in the same way, from the suggestion of non-political passion, the exasperation of a hungry man, an act of social revenge. All this is used up. It is no longer instructive as an object lesson in revolutionary anarchism. Every newspaper has ready-made phrases to explain such manifestations away. Let me give you, Mr. Verloc, my philosophy of bomb throwing. The sensibilities of the classes you are attacking are too soon blunted. You can't count on their emotions, either of pity or fear, for very long. A bomb outrage to have any influence on public opinion now must go beyond the intention of vengeance. It must be purely destructive. It must be that and only that, beyond the faintest suspicion of any other object. You anarchists should make it clear that you are perfectly determined to make a clean sweep of the whole social creation. But how to get that appallingly absurd notion into the heads of the middle classes so that there should be no mistake? That's the question. By directing your blows at something outside the ordinary passions of humanity is the answer. Of course, there is art. A bomb in the National Gallery would make some noise, but it would not be serious enough. Art has never been their fetish. It's like breaking a few back windows in a man's house, whereas if you really want to make him sit up, you must try at least to raise the roof. There would be some screaming, of course, but from whom? Artists, art critics, and such like? People of no account. Nobody minds what they say. But then there is learning. Science. Any imbecile that's got an income believes in that. He does not know why, but he believes it matters somehow. It is the sacrosanct fetish of the day. All the damned professors, they may be radicals at heart, but let them know that their great panjandrum has got to go to make room for the future of the proletariat, and well... Mr. Verloc, a howl from all these intellectual idiots is bound to help forward the labors of the Milan Conference. They will be writing to all the papers. Their indignation will be above suspicion, no material interest being openly at stake, and it would alarm every selfishness of the class which should be impressed. They believe that in some mysterious way, science is the source of their material prosperity. They do, and the absurd ferocity of such a demonstration will affect them more profoundly than the mangling of a whole street or theater full of their own kind. To that last, they can always say, it's mere class hate. But what is one to say of an act of destructive ferocity so absurd as to be incomprehensible? Inexplicable, almost unthinkable, in fact, mad. Madness alone is truly terrifying, inasmuch as you cannot placate it either by threats, persuasion, or bribes. The demonstration must be against learning, science. The attack must have all the shocking senselessness of gratuitous blasphemy. If only one could lob a bomb into pure mathematics. But alas, unfortunately, that is impossible. After his speech, Mr. Vladimir instructs Verloc to bomb the Greenwich Observatory, setting off an intrigue that ends in misery and death. Joseph Conrad wrote The Secret Agent for a different century than the one we live in now, but the plot, the story, and the characters... they are not at all out of place in our world. In fact, after the events of 2001, The Secret Agent took on an aura of prophecy, Many saw the destruction of the Twin Towers as Mr. Vladimir's ultimate act of destructive ferocity. But I fear that we may yet see an even more faithful reenactment of the secret agent. Because while it is still impossible to lob a bomb into pure mathematics, one can definitely toss one into the internet. You know, we could spend hours talking about the many ways in which Joseph Conrad's secret agent resonates with our own time and our own faith in technology and fears of terrorism. But instead, let's go back to the late 19th century, to the world of real-life anarchist cells and real-life police sabotage.
I wanted to unpack the reality of what was happening around Conrad's novel, The Secret Agent, and an attempt to discover how close it was to facts. And in fact, I get to a point where I realized that it was almost reportage, and he was living very close to it at the time he wrote the book 15 years later.
When Alex Butterworth set out to write his book, The World That Never Was, A History of the Anarchist Movement of the Late 19th Century, he discovered that many of the situations and characters in Conrad's Secret Agent had real-life counterparts. In a way, it was the same plot.
It's this story of the kind of terrorist cells operating, but how they're manipulated and provoked by the international police. Well, the origins of the book were kind of various. On the one hand, I had a writerly interest in producing a group biography and kind of dealing with that technically. I wanted to look at the kind of tradition of radicalism and utopianism. These were abstract ideas, but I also had a long-standing fascination with the reality of what was happening around that, and to understand the extent of conspiracy and what was first described as really being the first war on terrorism in the 1890s. I sort of look at the title, The World That Never Was, as having three meanings, really. One is the kind of great globe that one of the characters is trying to create to enlighten mankind. The other is The World That Never Was, as the anarchists hoped it would one day be. But the third is this idea of a worldwide global conspiracy that was promulgated by the secret services at the time for their own nefarious purposes.
The World That Never Was is a global story. The anarchists conspire to create an international network to topple the old government and usher in a new era for mankind. But it turns out the police, they're much better at the conspiracy game.
In some ways, I think the conspiracy of the police was more real than that of the anarchists. You have to remember that at the beginning of this period, one of the great progenitors of anarchism, Michael Bakunin, the Russian, and befriended a young kind of dynamic militant called Nechayev, and they kind of persuaded each other of their credibility by inventing vast networks of conspiratorial cells that they kind of had lined up behind them for the Revolutionary War. But it was all fantasy. And in some ways, that set the agenda. So after the assassination of the Tsar in Russia, the reactionary forces created their own equivalent, the Holy Brotherhood. In fact, it was populated largely by members of the St. Petersburg Yacht Club, and they came up with all kinds of wild schemes to discredit the anarchists as they'd fled abroad, blowing up cows and this sort of thing. But that was because they felt the need to create a kind of a parallel conspiratorial structure. And what happened was the conspiratorial structure they created was more real than that they were trying to combat.
Now, the chief architect for the secret police, the man Conrad based Mr. Vladimir on, is a Russian named Peter Rachkovsky. He runs the Foreign Bureau of the Russian secret police, the Okhrana, from Paris, France.
He organized cross-border raids from France into Switzerland to break up the revolutionary presses that were pumping out this kind of anti-Tsarist propaganda. And there are wonderful accounts of his agents going over there and breaking in and having to work without light so that they aren't discovered, and shredding papers until they're knee-deep in shreds. And at the same time, he was recruiting extraordinarily efficient and effective undercover agents for deep cover work who would penetrate the revolutionary movement and over a 5-10 year period sort of kind of usurp control of it and manipulate it and provoke it to an extent where many of those involved were carrying out or about to carry out acts of violence to which they might otherwise not have moved. And he does that with extraordinary efficiency and ruthlessness, and for 15 years becomes a kind of a linchpin of what's going on around terrorism and revolutionary behavior in Western countries as well as in Russia, and even, I think, probably stretching over to America. He's largely, I think, working beneath the radar. It's only at the end of that period, in 1894, just after a French anarchist in London has failed to blow up the Royal Observatory at Greenwich, which was, of course, the basis for Conrad's story, that there is a moment in the Belgian city of Liège where a series of bombs go off, an attempt to blow up the cathedral, prominent citizens' homes and this sort of thing. And the police investigation traces it back to a man called Monsieur Léonard in Paris. And, of course, Léonard is Ratchkovsky's wife's maiden name, and the address is that of the Russian embassy. And so for a moment we catch a glimpse of that he is actually completely complicit in these sorts of terrorist activities, even when the bombs are actually left to go off. It's covered up. The Belgian cabinet sequester all the papers, and I've only reached it by kind of delving through the crumbs in the archives.
Now, Mr. Vladimir, Conrad's fictional creation, enjoyed a sort of renaissance of sorts after the events of September 11th. Many people, myself included, felt he offered us a warning about what could go wrong with a war on terror. But Ratchkovsky, who's the real thing, seems to offer us even more. A historical record for the contemporary conspiracy theorists to draw upon.
It certainly wasn't my sense in embarking on the book to fuel conspiracy theories. But it is unmistakable that what has long been understood as the first war on terror was actually, in many cases, something quite different. Of course, which is not to suggest that there weren't violent anarchists who were bent on overturning the status quo. But the methods used to prevent the perceived and, I think, overstated danger of anarchist revolution entailed what would now be termed horrific blowback, which stretches for half a century and beyond.
Many of Ratchkovsky's dirty tricks and methods are still relevant today. He's kind of a founding father for international intrigue. In fact, his greatest piece of sabotage is still spinning out of control. It's probably one of the most successful pieces of propaganda malware ever written. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Ratchkovsky himself has had a long history of involvement in anti-Semitic activity from the early pogroms 20 years before. In fact, I think this document was probably intended as much as anything for kind of personal purposes of personal rivalry and to do down certain people who he wanted to do down in his local in the court. But it's almost certainly he who, in around 1897, was involved in commissioning the forgery or the compilation of a document called The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is now notorious and is still believed in many Middle Eastern countries, which, of course, is this idea of a vast conspiracy of Zionists who have harnessed all other subversive political factions, Freemasons and anarchists and socialists, to do their bidding in an attempt to gain world domination. But by the beginning of the 20th century, the very beginning, it's been taken up, and the Black Hundreds in Russia are beginning to organize vast pogroms and drawing on the document for inspiration. And at the same time, many of the terrorist cells in which he's planted double agents are also kind of getting out of control. That a man particularly called Azef, who's one of his creatures, comes to head the socialist revolutionaries in Russia and embarks on the organization, embarks on a kind of killing spree of Tsarist officials. And by the time Ratchkovsky returned to the police force in 1905 after the first sort of abortive Russian Revolution, it's almost sort of escaped his grasp. And so, you know, the conspiracy isn't only his, but he's someone who exploits that kind of credulity. This is a period that is hugely susceptible to ideas of conspiracy. And I think, you know, the lessons are that we today live in another age of credulity in some respects, where technology provides the means for its even more rapid dissemination. And you have to be very careful how you handle that. It can very easily slip out of your grasp.
This episode of Too Much Information is called Sabotage. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Bill Bowen and Laura Mayer, and featured Peter Choice, Julia Wirtz, Nart Villeneuve, and Alex Butterworth. On the TMI playlist page, you can find links and images, and you can subscribe to the TMI podcast. All that at WFMU.org. And you are listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and WFMU.org.